40s. I've been fortunate enough to manage to dope it out for the iPad, which is an Apple product. Trying to do the same thing for the Kindle, which is also a tablet. I believe it's what they call an Android operating system. Just want to be able to print directly to my brother printer from that tablet without going through an intermediate computer.
You've got it, Joe. Yeah, roger that. I'm sorry, I meant to say what operating system are you using, whether it was Windows or Mac OS. Just give me 1 minute, I'll look it up for you, and then, Dick, with your permission, I'll break in and give them that information. W2BMP.
Okay, it's Windows 7, Windows 7.
Okay, so come back to that when you've got it, Joe. Looks like you're going to get an answer after all, Mel. Next person on the list was Joe, WB2RYY. Oh, well, had your call for this wrong, Joe. I know you so well. Go right ahead, Joe. K2RIW.
Good evening, Dick. You'll always confuse me with Richie. Can you read me okay?
Reading you loud and clear.
Okay, here we go. Here's the question. Not a very hard one at all. Sometimes you put up antennas, and sometimes they come down. And sometimes when they come down, they hit things and bend. And the antenna I have in question is a directional UHF beam that came down, and some of the elements got bent. This has elements that are something like about 3/8 of an inch diameter, solid aluminum construction, and the boom is the same way. I'd like to know the safest way, without breaking the elements, to be able to restrain the elements to back to their normal physical appearance of how the antenna was initially constructed, like the bent forward or bent backwards, whatever, by as much as the 45-degree angle. Back to you.
To a certain degree, Joe, you've asked the right question to the right guy. When I was building the so-called RIW-19 element, Yagi, on 432 megacycles on my backyard, radiometry antenna range, where I could resolve 0.05 dB, a 20th of a dB of gain increase or decrease. What I was doing during that process, I wanted to find out how much action I was getting out of each one of those 17 or 16 directors. And so each one of the directors were mounted on a plastic block, and the plastic block was held onto the boom by way of a tie wrap. So I could rotate each one of the elements one at a time completely vertical. They were now perpendicular to the rest of the antenna, and it took them out of the operation entirely. It became transparent. In the process of doing that, I discovered that individual elements of a Yagi can be tilted about 30 degrees. The whole darn element tilted 30 degrees before you can even measure something has happened. You'd be amazed how forgiving that is. Let me drop. The bottom line of all this is that when you're straightening out the elements of a Yagi, 90% of what you're doing is only reestablishing the beauty of what your eye sees. The RF doesn't give a damn. Up to 30 degrees of tilt. Therefore, what I've done in the case of my Cushcraft Yagis, which every so often get bent because they've only got 8-inch diameter elements on 2 meters, way too skinny, way too fragile, and they're always getting bent up. And you're very tempted to walk over there and straighten out the exact bend location so that it looks perfectly straight again. You're very tempted to do that. Do not do that on a Cushcraft Yagi. You take that 45-degree bend you've got on that particular element, and you try to completely straighten it out. You're going to be doing grain hardening of that aluminum, and most likely that element will break off. My suggestion in the case of the Cushcraft 8-inch element diameter Yagis, 8-inch diameter, is that you rebend it back, not in the same location. Move a half an inch or an inch uprange or downrange, and then bend it back. And yes, when you're up close to the Yagi, you're going to see a little bit of a zigzag. But you didn't bend forward and then bend back the exact same location. You do that, and most likely it's going to snap. It's not quite as pretty looking, but you get back 90% of the beauty if you bend it back at an adjacent location. Wonder if it makes some sense, Joe. And it works for me. The V2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
W2BMP.
No, it doesn't make any sense to me because I'm not using a Cushcraft antenna, number one. And number two, These the elements are solid aluminum elements that are 3/8 of an inch diameter. So they're definitely bigger than a quarter inch. At least they're not anywhere near as thin as the antenna elements on a Cushcraft antenna. This antenna is a commercially made UHF Yagi antenna. I'd like to restore it to what it originally looked like. I understand what you're saying, Dick, but I would like to put it back to normal, and I don't want to break the elements if I can possibly help it. They're welded onto the boom, so they're not moving.
Comment, Dick?
Okay, yeah. Joe PMP, stand by a little bit. John first. Go ahead, John.
Yes, Dick, I was just going to recommend if Joe wants to straighten out solid aluminum elements, use a V-block and a propane torch. Heat it to anneal it and put it in a V-block. Just tighten the clamp. It should straighten right out.
You're fairly sure that aluminum will survive? I mean, his aluminum might be 6061 T6. The T6 is a thermal tempering of the aluminum. And so by this heating, annealing, and reshaping, maybe he's going to come back to T3, but maybe that's good enough. Is that sort of what you're saying, Joe? The V2 GLW, K2RIW? Sorry about the WB2 WG. You know who you are. KC2 WGB. Boy, I'm really losing it today. You got it, John.
Yes, Dick, exactly. He'll be able to tell as he tightens the B-block. He'll be able to tell just by the amount of effort it's going to take. It should move in quite smoothly. I've done it before. I don't know the exact aluminum content or the metallurgy involved, but it was aluminum and it was antenna. It was 3/8. I also did it with quarter inch, and they were all both solid. A little tricky, but it can be done.
I presume you were doing that heating with something like a blowtorch. What was your method of knowing when you had done the right amount of heating? Because when you're heating aluminum to soften it, you go a couple of degrees beyond that, and all of a sudden it melts and drips away. So you got to be very careful. How did you do that heating at just the right temperature, John? Go ahead.
Dick, I used a gas called MAP gas, M-A-P-P, and I watched for the discoloration as you heat it and you whisk back and forth for, say, 3 inches, and you will see the color of the aluminum start to change. It gets dark at the outer edges, and it's lighter in the center. As soon as you hit that point, you can tighten down on the V-block, and it'll straighten right out.
That sounds awful good, John. That was John and Joe. You got any further questions on that, Joe, before we go over to, this is Joe RYY, WB2RYY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Joe.
Yes, I was trying to ask a question before, but this radio doesn't work correctly all the time. I push the button and you don't hear me at the other end. What's a V-block, if that's the word you're using?
Yes. The Victor Eddie V-block. You should be able to get that at the Harbor Freight and Salvage.
Yeah, let me make some guesses on this one. V-block, in other words, you've got a block of steel, probably, with a V-shaped notch in it that goes along the whole length. I'm guessing you buy them in pairs. You buy them in such a way that they are made for a particular diameter of rod that goes in between. And so when you have one of these V-blocks below the element, one of the V-blocks above the element, and you start squeezing down on it with something like a great big C-clamp, you're forcing everything to be nice and straight. Is that approximately what you're describing, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW?
Very similar, Dick. It's a machinist tool that's used to hold round stock when you want to drill holes in it. It comes with, it's about maybe 3 inches long and about an inch square, and you can chuck anything from quarter inch to maybe inch and a quarter round stock in it. And you may be able to buy just one of them. You shouldn't need any more than that. And it comes with what looks like something like a horseshoe magnet, and it slides into the tracks that are cut into the side. And it has a threaded rod that goes down on the top to apply pressure. And it has a little ring land that presses on the aluminum. You can also add another, piece of stock if you want to distribute the effort along that length. And also it depends, I mean, if it's bent at a 90 degree, no, that's not going to work. But if it's just bent at an angle and it's the radius of curvature is uniform, it should straighten right out. Back to you, Dick.
John, roughly how many dollars is this thing, and what place do I go to buy it? I don't think I can buy that at Harbor Freight, and I don't think I can buy that at Home Depot. Roughly how many dollars, what brand name, where do I go to buy it? You got it, John.
Well, the ones I have are made by L.S. Starrick. You don't have to buy those, but Harbor Freight will have them because they do have a lot of machine tools, and that's a very common tool for a machinist. It's ubiquitous in the machine industry world. So, and I would say you could probably get it on eBay for like $5, but maybe $20 new for a pair.
You got it, Joe. Do you need any further questions?
A V-block. So this attaches to the antenna element, and then you heat the element up with a propane torch, whatever, and just try to bend it back. Is that what you're basically saying?
I think he's saying you heat the element outside of the V-block first. Then you put it in the V-block, and the V-block has a clamping mechanism that forces it down into the V, that forces it to be straight. I think that's what you're saying. We're going to turn it back to John for a refill on that.
You got it, Dick. That's right.
But you want to add anything to the actual... Go step by step as to what you did. I think the element is sitting out in the air. You're waving your map gas torch across it, looking for that coloration change that tells you you're at the right temperature. Once you hit that temperature, real quick, you slap this V-block against the bottom of the element. The clamping mechanism goes on top of the element, forces it down into the V, and forces it to be straight. Is that approximately what happened, Joe? Hi, John. WGB, K2LIW.
You got it, Dick. Give that man a cigar, as you say. Remember, you can't have the block on there because it's a huge heat sink. You'd never get it up to temperature. But exactly the way you said it, that's the way you do it. You may have to do it a couple of times, but it'll work right in.
A1MGM. Okay. K1MGM. Mike, Golf Mike, it sounds like. Tell me your name, sir, and give us your hint on how to do this.
This is Mike, and this is K1 Mike Juliet Mike. I just turned the radio on, and I think I hear an antenna parts being reworked. Are they aluminum?
Yes, Mike. This is a commercial Yagi-like structure, roughly quarter-inch diameter elements that are welded into the boom. Some of the elements became bent. He wants to straighten them out. And so you probably heard that John was recommending that heating the elements and forcing them into a V-block as a straightening mechanism. Back to you, Mike. K1 Mike, Juliet Mike, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Roger that. I agree with all of the Z-block thing. I had a machine shop for several years. The thing I'm concerned with was color change. Aluminum melts at between 1,015 and 1,025 degrees, and it's going to melt before it gets a color change, so that's just something I'm a little bit concerned about hearing.
Yeah, I said something similar to that earlier, Mike. That's what I was worried about. The temperature at which you heat aluminum to where it is soft and easy to bend, and a couple of degrees above it, I'm exaggerating a little bit, it melts and drips away, and you're in a heap of trouble. And so I think it was 6061 T6 aluminum, maybe with some anodizing or whatever on the surface. And so when John was heating it with his map gas torch, he saw a characteristic change in the surface that led him to believe that he was at the softening temperature and hadn't yet reached the melting temperature. I am guessing this outdoor-rated, commercial-grade Yagi is probably made out of 6061 T6 alloy. I know he's going to lose the T6 tempering when he does this annealing and rebending process, but I don't think that's going to be a big problem for him. So I wonder if you have any other suggestion, Mike, as to how he can arrive at the right temperature. Yeah, I guess you can buy from Harbor Freight, by the way, these contactless thermometers. In other words, it's a laser beam coming out of an interferometer which helps you aim it at something, and it measures the temperatures of things. And so you don't have to worry about the emissivity of the aluminum and the correction factor, but maybe maybe that's a way of knowing when you've come to the right temperature. So when you ran your machine shop, Mike, how did you know when you hit the right temperature? K1, Mike, Juliet, Mike, K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is K1 MJM. Normally you would heat it in an oven and anneal it at the correct temperature. As far as losing the temper, it will drop down to what they call a T0 to T2 temper after you heat it to that annealing temperature. But over time, usually several days to about a week, it will naturally age harden back up to T4 temper again. It has to be they call precipitation hardened or artificially hardened if you want to get it back to T6 though.
Now bear in mind, Mike, that this is a complete UHF Yagi. I don't think he has a chance of putting that whole damn thing in an oven, and because of the connector and the Teflon and everything else in there, he doesn't want to do that. He only wants to heat up the element that has been bent. So do you have any suggestions for how he can do that? And before you transmit, Mike, wait for the four beeps. K1 Mike, Juliet Mike, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Roger, I think your idea with the laser, the non-contacting infrared laser thermometer, I think that's a great idea. Probably 750, 850F at max. Don't go much over that because you're going to start distorting it, warping it. Again, that melting temperature is a little over 1,000 degrees, and once you get there, it falls apart really, really fast. The Z-block idea is a fine idea, too.
Yeah, so the good news, Joe, is that Harbor Freight has got these very inexpensive non-contacting thermometer. It's got a laser beam to it. By way of the red dot, you'll know exactly what you're measuring the temperature of, and the thing will sit there and read out the temperature for you. So that's a way you could measure the temperature of that element as you heat it, and it looks like Mike is telling you to go to 750F and don't go to 1,000. And good luck with this one, Joe, and as you bend that back, come back and let us know how this worked. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Is that from MAP to propane, then? Don't use MAP gas.
Let's have a couple words on that, John. What's wrong with MAP and aluminum versus propane? Are you saying we got dissimilar metal problems or something here? WGB, take it, K-2-R-I-W.
Dick, if he uses propane torch with a flare, he won't have a chance of getting up to that temperature. MAP gas is a little hotter, so I would suggest you use propane instead of MAP. That would have been an error. Then I don't think he has a chance of damaging that. And he'll be able to see, I wasn't talking about the metal changing color, but if you've ever taken a torch to metal, where the torch hits looks lighter, and you see a wave that sort of has a... it goes out in a circular pattern. You can actually see the heat transferring. That's what I'm talking about. Not an actual discoloration of the metal.
Okay, if I understand you correctly, the flame of the propane torch changes its characteristic color in that little hot spot when the aluminum you're heating approaches the right temperature. That's what I think you're saying. Is that true, John? Go ahead.
Well, you'll see the rings start in the center, and they radiate out, circular pattern. And as it gets out to about 3 inches, depending, of course, on the radius of that curvature, that's when he'll be able to move it. And, you know, he can do it in increments if he wants. But I don't think he'll have much trouble doing it, depending on how badly this thing is bent, too.
Okay, so I think you've got quite a few hints here, Joe, that's going to help. W-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
He had a sample piece that it would be nice for him to try first. Maybe he's got a scrap piece laying around.
Very much. Somebody's transmitting on top of me. All these elements, there's about three of them on the boom that are bent. They're all bent at the boom itself. They're not bent like halfway down the element. So it's going to be hard to wrap something around this thing and get it, you know, whatever it's block you talk about. It's going to be hard to put it like right next to the boom itself. I thought of using something like possibly a small diameter pipe to be able to go over the element itself, to be able to, you know, contain the element itself to be able to bend it back. But I guess the key is the heat thing up
to about 750. And yes, I own a non-contact thermometer to be able to measure that if they go up, if the thing will go up that high.
I'm in, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
The fellow with the machine shop would probably be better explanation for this, but if he tries the pipe idea, more than likely it's going to break at the weld on the boom itself. The weld won't break, but the material will break at the weld.
Yeah, give us a couple of words on that, John. In other words, some kind of once-in-a-lifetime tempering took place at the aluminum weld, and I think you're saying you don't want to reheat that area. You want to heat an area, let me pick a number, a half inch further out from the boom. And although it's going to be not perfect, maybe that's what you're suggesting. And if he puts a piece of pipe over the element, so he's now got a longer lever arm, and it's also thermally isolated, as he's heating the area he's about to bend, I think he'll be able to feel the aluminum becoming softer. What do you think, John? I'm going to go over to John and then Mike in that order. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Yeah, Mike would probably have a better idea, but my feeling there is, working with metals, if he slides that pipe over, the weld itself is not going to fail. The material adjacent to the weld is going to fail. I can almost guarantee he'll snap the element right off. That's only my opinion. Let's see what Mike has to say. KC2WGB.
Okay, wait for the four beeps, and you've got it, Mike.
Let me clarify something again, because you keep on saying the wrong diameter. These are not quarter-inch elements, they're not eighth-inch elements, they're three-eighths diameter elements.
Roger, Dodger. Go ahead, Mike. Wait for the beeps.
Roger that. I think John's on the right track there also. Yeah, if you put something over it where the end of the pipe is, he's going to start creating a, well, depending on how close that pipe comes to the weld, he's going to create a stress riser there. But what he should do, as John is saying, just kind of gradually, lightly heat the area, depending on the thickness, the wall thickness of the tubing. The propane will melt it. It will reach 1,000 degrees, 1,100 degrees. It will melt it if he keeps it in one spot. So wave that torch around, kind of like gently heat the area, and try to bend it gradually as he's heating it. And as John said, there's a stress riser built in that what they call heat-affected zone at the edge of the weld, so be careful with that.
And John, I know what Joe's going to tell us, and that is the elements are 3/8 of an inch diameter solid aluminum. They're not tubing. Does that change anything about your recommendation, Mike? K1 Mike, Juliet Mike, K2LIW.
Negative. I think everything should still work the same. He could put a little more heat to it that way, but if he has that thermometer, that infrared thermometer, that'll help a lot. Again, if it's solid, I don't think he'll have a chance of melting. If it were tubing, definitely be careful. But same technique should work. Again, be careful at that weld zone, that heat effective zone. That's the soft point or the weak point.
I think you're saying that the aluminum is more likely to crystallize in the vicinity of that weld if he tries to reheat it and bend it. So avoid that area. Leave that area quasi-cold and move a half inch out from the boom and do the bending there. And even though it's going to have a little bit of a zigzag in the element, that's just minor beauty. RF-wise will have no effect. I think that's sort of what you're suggesting, Mike. Is that true? Back to you, Mike.
Critical heat effective zone if possible. If he could tolerate that little bit of a bend. Otherwise, yeah, what John and you were saying, that sounds pretty much right on.
Okay, you got an additional comment, John? Go ahead.
Diameter and thickness of the boom.
Okay, I don't think it matters, but what's your guess as to the diameter and thickness of the boom, John? Here we go, Joe.
Inch boom diameter.
5/16 of an inch. Is that what you said, John? Joe?
3/4 of an inch. 0.75 inches.
Okay, 0.75 inches is, I think you're saying, the wall thickness of the boom. Okay. Does anybody think that that's a problem?
Dick, he's saying it's 3/4 inch square. Thickness of the metal?
Yeah, make it a little more clear, Joe. 3/4 inch is what?
I don't know why you're not listening to me. The boom is solid. The elements on the boom that are welded to the boom are solid. This does not have any, it's not hollow, it's not a ham antenna. It's a commercial constructed beam.
Okay, we got the picture now. 3/4 inch square boom, 3/8 inch solid aluminum elements. Now that everybody knows that, does that make any difference in what you recommend?
Joe doesn't understand that some of his words got cut out by this interference. Okay, so it's a solid boom, 3/4 inch square, 3/8 elements on it. Okay, that's a good heat sink on the boom. So on that side of the stress, I think you've got a good heat reliever. And I think it should work well for him.
Okay, now that Mike has that, any further suggestions, Mike? MJM, K2LAW?
I didn't square. I haven't heard it said these are round elements. They're not square at all.
Yeah, some of your words are being cut out, Joe. We know that the elements are round. We think the boom is 3/4 inch square. Do we have it right, Joe?
No, you don't. The boom is 3/4 inch round. 0.75 inches round.
Okay, that's okay, Dick.
Okay, so everything is round. So, Mike, any further suggestions now that we know it's 3/4 inch round boom, 3/8 elements, round, solid aluminum? MJM for any final words, K2LIW.
Negative, everything stays the same. No other comments, I think he's good.
Okay, good luck with that project, Joe. Let us know how that turns out. I think we've gone through the list of everybody who signed in. Yes, we have. It's quite delayed, but go right ahead for the mailbag, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Whiskey 2, Bravo, Mike Papa.
KC2WGB. All right, Dick, we have a gentleman named Tom. Call sign, KD2CKO. You've talked to him a couple of times, and so have I. Great guy, and one of our nation's soldiers who was in a forward position a couple of times, and he has a question. Let me let it drop.
Whiskey 2, Bravo, Mike Papa.
Yeah, stand by a minute, John. I forgot to pick up Joe. WB2, BMP, go right ahead with Mel's information.
Thanks, Dick. I just wanted to answer the question. For that gentleman looking for the Android application, the application is called PrintShare by Mobile Dynamics. That's Dynamics with X as in X-ray, not C as in Charlie. And that'll get him going printing from any Android device. W2BMP.
Once again, please.
Okay, I think that was Mel. Mel, was that you asking for a repeat?
Richard Azure.
Okay, Joe, please repeat for Mel.
Yeah, Mel, the application is called PrintShare. It is free. It's from a company called Mobile Dynamics. That's Dynamics with an X as an X-ray. It is free. You can load it on any Android device, and it will print to any printer you wish. If you want the exact URL, it's hard to find. You can email me, which is whiskey2bravomikepapa@yahoo.com.
All right. A little bit of interference there, but I'm trying to write and listen at the same time. I have PrintShare, and I'm sorry, what was the name of the firm that puts it out?
The company is Mobile Dynamics. Dynamics ends with an X as in X-ray, not a C as in Charlie.
If I can find it, I tried getting an app from the Google store, but I don't think they support this device, but we'll see what happens. Joe, I appreciate it very much. Dick, I appreciate your help, too. Turn it back to the net and continue with your mailbag. This is K2MC Clear. Thank you, gentlemen.
W2BMP.
Comment on the Kindle printing. Name is Bill.
Go ahead, Bill.
There's a search on the computer. It appears you cannot use an application to print directly from a Kindle to a printer. You have to convert on the Kindle to a PDF file, send it to a computer, and then print it. That seems to be the issue. And the words I keyed in, how to print from a Kindle to a Brother printer, and it gave me several choices, and I read through them as we were listening to the discussion. I don't believe there is an application that you can download to a Kindle and print directly, use that to print directly to a printer. But I could be mistaken on that. But I just want to indicate that. Back to the net.
Joe, you're the guy who found that application. Do you want to add anything to this? WB2BMP, K2RIW.
Yeah, I use this application all the time. It works fine for my Kindle. Yeah, they can email me at whiskey2bravo@yahoo.com, and I'll send them the link to the Android Market, and it's a free download.
Okay, looks like we've got a solution on that one. And if not, Joey's offering further aid to make that work. And when you make that work, come back and let us know about that one, Mel. John, now, I prematurely went over to you. KC2WGB, K2RIW with the soldier story.
Okay, Dick, no problem. Yeah, this fine gentleman, Tom, recently separated from the military, who is in New York at this time. He's moving to California to be with his son. And on the way, he's going to bring his 5-watt HT. And he needs to know, can he go online and find repeater directories that will sort of cover a route to California, which he's headed for. He knows there's some simplex calling frequencies, but he doesn't know about repeaters and traveling across the country. Is there anybody listening to the net right now who could maybe give us some information, maybe some websites he could look on, anything at all that could help him out? Back to you, Dick. KC2WGP.
I suspect there is. I vaguely remember at one time there was a service which would give you a map of the New England area, for instance, and on the map you saw the call letters of each one of the repeaters with a dot on the map, so as you drove through that town you know what was the local repeater, and it told you the frequency in that PL tone. So I'm pretty sure in certain areas of the country there are maps like that that are available online. I know also that the ARL repeater directory has that information, but not quite as user-friendly form. You have to turn to the right page of each individual state. Then it lists the repeaters usually by county or by northeast and southwest portion of the state. That helps some. It would be much nicer to have this real map where the dot of each one of the repeaters are on the map. And as you drive on that particular road through that particular town, you'll know immediately how close you are and whether or not you'll have a good coverage of that particular repeater. So anyone online, anyone done in the sound of our voice right now, who knows of any of these websites that a person could go to or services that you can purchase where they show you a map and show you the actual repeaters as dots on that map with the call letters, frequency, and PL tone on the map, that would be awful helpful. Give me your call letters right now, K2RIW and the Tech Man.
If you choose that I comment.
Hey, Gabe again?
E-G.
Okay, that was a triple. I heard something ZI. Start off with you first. Go ahead.
K2RIW, this is AB2ZI, Kevin. Yes, I use an iPhone application called Freak Finder. That's Foxtrot Romeo Echo Quebec Finder. It identifies any repeater in the country by your location as given by the GPS in the phone. Very handy app. You can sort it by frequency or by distance from your location. And
Okay, that was very helpful, Kevin. So, Freak Finder has what you're describing. Is that a website? Is that a thing that you purchase? How do I get my hands on the thing called Freak Finder? Over to you, Kevin.
Yes, AB2ZI. It's an iPhone application. It would go to iTunes and download it for your iPhone. I'm not sure if he has it for other platforms. The gentleman that does it is a ham, and he has that in one other application that's not relevant. AB2ZI, back to that.
Yeah, whiskey.
Okay, Kevin, that's good information. Somebody else has some information, and I heard blank whiskey. Go right ahead with that. Give me a full set of call letters, and I know that somebody else is trying to get in with internet with EchoLink. We'll get to you in a minute. The person who said something whiskey, give me your full call name and your information. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Victor Echo 3, Juliet India Whiskey, Jim.
Okay, Jim. You've been around for a long time. Sorry to give you so much grief. Go right ahead, Jim.
Charlie 6 or 7, Nelson. There is, and it may not suit DHT, but I have a feeling a lot of these applications present a lot of visual data to you, and it's going to probably visual data too. There's a Bluetooth adapter that works between a Yaesu 857, maybe 897, and Android. And it programs the radio. And I'm thinking some of these apps also give you visual displays and stuff. It is an Android. And I'm thinking an IRLP finder would give IRLP notes, but it won't list standard voice repeaters. That's all. BE3JIW, back to net.
Okay, John is collecting this information. And John, did you get enough of that from Jim to make sense, that you know what to do? KC2WGB for a possible fill, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick, and also I will give Tom the information for reviewing the TechNet on the web, so he'll be able to get all this data firsthand.
W2NDG.
Okay, W2 November Delta Golf is what it sounds like. Go right here with your information, sir.
Eugene? All of the solutions offered are if this person has a smartphone, which they may not have. So there's a couple of websites I'll give out here real quick that you can plot the route in advance and maybe list some repeaters. One is www.artscipub, that's ARTSCIPUB, artscipub.com/repeaters, and that's a U.S. repeater database. Another one is www.levinecentral.com, L-E-V-I-N-E, central.com/repeaters. That's also, both of these have mapping functions, so you can bring up the repeaters in an area by map and then write them down. As far as the smartphone apps, though, when I've tried all of them, and the most accurate one still is written by a Limark member, Bob, and that's R Finder, and it's available for iPhone and Android both. W2NDG, back to net.
That sounds like some darn good information, Mr. NDG. Oh, I see. I spelled it wrong. I wonder if I couldn't find it. I wonder if you need a fill on any of that, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Those sites sound exactly what he needs, where he can plot a route. That's very good information. Great. Great stuff. Back to you, Dick.
This is Kilo Delta 2, Charlie Kilo Oscar, the gentleman in question for the comment, if I may.
There he is.
Charlie Kilo Oscar, go right ahead.
Let's see if I can power through this, but those two websites should be what I'm looking for. I have RF Finder. The problem is I'm trying to do this preempt before I'm on the road, so I'm not trying to mess with websites should set it up pretty well for me. So thank you to whoever that was out there. This is KD2CKO. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW.
Okay, Mr. CKO, sounds like we got what you're looking for. Back to you, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Yeah, Dick, don't forget to mail my bill. We actually did something. Let me let it drop and we'll go to the next one. Alrighty. I have a ham who has a problem with his car. Okay. He gets static on his AM radio in the car, also on any of his AM equipment he brings into the car, whether it be battery-operated or powered off the cigar lighter. It only happens when the car is moving, and, of course, that makes it very difficult to troubleshoot. He's had it into a couple of engine specialists and car specialists. They cannot find where the noise is coming from. It's a static sound. It's not a whine, and it seems to be activated when he's on a rough road more than on a smooth road. Do you have any way or know any way he can troubleshoot this and narrow it down? Back to you, Dick. Maybe you can help. AC2WGB.
Do you happen to know what band we're talking about here, John? Is this a 2 meter or 450? Is it 80 meters? What frequency do you believe is the operation? Because that will make a bit of a difference. Over to you, John.
Dick, it's pretty random. He hears it occasionally on the 2 meter FM. He hears it on AM radios, broadcast, or ham. He hears it almost on everything he brings into the car.
Wow. You probably know what I was about to suggest is to do a divide and conquer. Feed the mobile radio with a completely separate battery so you're not using the power supply of the car. However, if he's getting it on the AM radio of the car, well, wait a minute now, that's all being fed by car power. There's still a small chance that something is funny about the car power, that if he's using some kind of a separate battery held on the floor of the car or on the seat of the car that's feeding power to the ham radio receiver while driving down the road, that will at least tell him that it's most likely not the the power supply of the car making the extraneous noise. And that's a little bit of a long shot because a well-designed mobile radio knows that there's all kinds of glitches and spikes on mobile 12-volt power, and therefore they should be protected from it. The next thing I'd worry about is the antenna itself. If the coax cable going to the antenna is frayed, either at the antenna end or at the connector of the rig end, that can do some funny things with the vibration of the car. Temporarily, in the case of 2 meters, use another antenna. Put a mag mount on the roof of the car, run the cable through a window of the car, and plug it into the radio and see if the noise is still there. And if the noise is gone, then you know that there's something funny about the antenna, frayed cable, the antenna making a scratchy contact through, let me drop. The antenna making a scratchy contact through the paint, and the antenna is being intermittently grounded in a funny way. You take any metallic object in the near vicinity of an antenna on any frequency, and you just take two pieces of metal and scrape them against each other. You will make radio static. That's just the way radio is. It's extremely sensitive to any minor changes in metallic contact. Contacting in the vicinity of the antenna. I guess there's a slim possibility that the particular piece of sheet metal of the automobile that the antenna is mounted to is making funny, scratchy contacts with the rest of the metal of the automobile somewhere around the perimeter. There again, you'll get the partial information by running the mag mount and first run the mag mount on the hood of the car up front, on the bonnet of the car out back, on the roof of the car up top. Try the mag mount in various places. That'll give you some hints. So, is it antenna? There's only about three places the noise can come from. The 12-volt power,
something funny with the antenna, and something about the rig itself that doesn't like vibration. Let me drop. That's a long one.
But he also gets it on a handheld HT or an AM radio that he brings into the car, battery operated, isolated.
Whoa. A handy talkie in the car gets it. What's your guess? Is the handy talkie running on its rubber duck or on an external antenna? What do you think, John?
Handheld with the antenna that that he purchased with the HT. And the AM radio exhibits the same thing, little transistor radio that he brought in. When he switches to the FM band, he gets a lot less, but he still gets it.
Two QIQ.
Glenn recognized, and then once again, I think you said only when the car is rolling.
P2CLN.
CLN recognized, but we're going to go to a QIQ first. Go ahead, Glenn.
Hey, good evening, Dick. Good evening, John. This kind of problem sounds kind of familiar. There's certain cars, Dick, that are really poor choices for amateur radio. And I don't have a list of cars, but I think I'm going to start doing it. But some cars have problems with the ECMs that are inside the, between the fuel injection, not so much the fuel or the fuel pumps. They're actually kind of okay, but some fuel injectors just make a tremendous amount of noise between the computer and the fuel injector system, and there's just no way of shielding it, and the car is just extremely noisy. I think that the only way around this particular problem, if he wants to keep this particular car for amateur radio use, is to put an antenna that really increases the signal-to-noise ratio. But I think overall that this is going to be a problem he may never solve. It's just a matter of getting more signal-to-noise ratio in. But there's always going to be a baseline high noise figure in the car, just basically due to the electronics in the car, Dick. That's my feeling, at least anyway, because this is not the first time I've heard this particular problem. Back to you, Dick. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I'm going to ask both John and Glenn in this order. John, do you happen to know what kind of a car? And then I'm going to be asking Glenn at least one or two of the brand names and model numbers of cars that he knows that are bad on this. So, John, first, do you know the model number of the car that's got this problem? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
I know it's a Nissan. It's 4 years old, and it's been in the shop a couple of times to see if they can solve this problem. And it only happens when the car is moving. So maybe that'll help Glenn out a little bit. And don't forget, it also happens on broadcast.
Yeah, when the car is moving, that's when the fuel pump is running, when the fuel injectors are running, when the possibility of electrostatic static is happening. So, Glenn, is Nissan one of them? And do you happen to know at least one brand name that you know has got it, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, virtually being that I'm a Corvette enthusiast, Corvettes, anything with all plastic bodies or majority of large composite plastics throughout the car or mixes between metals and plastics make really poor choices. They just have very, very high background noise, especially when you're driving the car. And it's very, very hard to find good ground planes on certain vehicles. Another one is the Jeep Wranglers that have the plastic tops that unbolt and come off. Generally, cars that have high mixes between, you know, plastics and metals usually make very, very poor choices for trying to find a car with a low background noise. You know, some of the SUVs are actually some of the better choices because they have, you know, full metal all the way around. But there again, even some of the SUVs that have, like, composite or plastic lift gates in the back can create problems. So generally cars that have lots of sheet metal usually make some of the better choices, Dick, rather than getting into specific models of just things that I've observed so far. But there again, usually antennas that have very, very high signal-to-noise ratio where you can get a lot of reception signal usually will make it acceptable. But to try to get a very low noise figure might be very, very hard in some vehicles, Dick. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
John, good information, Glenn. Thank you. I wonder if Tom's got something to add to this.
WB2CLM, K2RIW. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, well, you should know I always do, Dick. I don't know what he has for testing, but a battery-powered oscilloscope looking at the power while he's driving can probably tell you quite a bit. If he doesn't have a battery-powered oscilloscope, go with a 10,000 microfarad electrolytic we'll be taking one thing at a time here. 10,000 microfarad at the 2-meter radio end and see what happens.
W2NDG.
Old.
Okay, very fine, Tom. W2NDG. See, he signed in earlier. Why in the world can I find him on my list? Mr. NDG? Oh, yeah, that's Neil. Go right ahead, Neil.
Something else to consider if it wasn't already mentioned. I had a 91 Mitsubishi, and I had a problem that I could never resolve with the AM radio in that car, and it happened on certain kinds of pavement, and dry pavement only. When it was wet, it wouldn't happen. It was a static buildup that was generated because of the type of tires that I had, and certain pavement would generate more static than other pavements. It was strange. It was temperature dependent. It was moisture dependent. And I never really resolved it. But I'm sure there's probably information on the internet about it now. I haven't looked it up because that was a long time ago, before the internet. So, but I would maybe look towards some sort of static issue. Back to net.
Thank you, Neil. Okay. We've got some hints on this one, but I think it's going to be a tough one. Thank you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Well, the only thing I could come up with, which I don't think he's tried, I hope he's listening, is I would suggest that he tries going downhill without the engine running. Turn the key on and see what happens. See if he gets it that way. That's the only suggestion I have. It really sounds like a weird problem, Dick.
I like that suggestion. Is it because of the engine and fuel pump and the fuel injectors running? Or is it just the car rolling itself, making vibration, building up static electricity on its wheels? In the old days, the grease cap on the wheels, the front wheels, used to have a little bit of a contacting device in order to stop the voltage buildup that took place across the grease of the wheel bearing. That was making radio noise. And nowadays they don't have that anymore. I guess it's because they put conductive material in the wheel bearing grease. That's a guess. Or they got some kind of a discharge device somewhere else. But I like the idea of rolling down the hill and the car the engine is turned off. You're in neutral going down the hill. Do you have the noise? Then turn on the engine while it's in neutral and race the engine. Do you have the noise? Then engage the engine. You got to be careful on this one. A smart guy would try to rev the engine the right number of RPM when you go from neutral to drive when you've done a colliding operation. You want to go a little bit easy on your transmission. I guess a super conservative person would bring the car to a stop before re-engaging the transmission. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I'm sure he appreciates all the input, so he's got a few things to check out. I don't think he'd know what to do with an oscilloscope in the car. I don't think he has that ability, but that is another way of doing it. Okay. Well, he's got a few things to try, and wish him luck with that one. I'm glad I don't own that car. Let me take a check here, and I'll go on to my next one.
And by the way, let me... backtrack a little bit. KD2CKO, when you go to his QRZ.com, beautiful picture of him in a camouflage uniform doing a military operation. Good thing to go look at. Back to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yeah, very interesting guy to talk to, and a lot of straight information about, you know, what goes on and some of the things they have to go through. I've spoken to him quite a few times, and good information, and I thank him for his service. Let me get the next one. Okay, now we've got a little bit of a science question. If you remember photographs of atomic bombs above ground testing, going back to Yucca Flats and the ones they did at sea, you'll always notice that when they fire the weapon, there are rockets that take off at the same time. They go straight up. And I often wonder this too. What are they for? Are they to determine the altitude of the mushroom? Or do they carry sensing devices? Maybe you know about that, Dick. I have no information at all on that. Never even thought about it. But I've seen them. I'm sure you have too. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Wow. I'm sorry to say I have not seen those rockets on atomic bomb incidents. I remember seeing that shockwave that spreads across the water and eventually encounters the cameraman. I remember seeing all kinds of things. I don't remember seeing rockets going off. That's a new one on me. Let's see if anyone on frequency has some information about the rockets that get launched at a nuclear test site. Because I haven't seen it. Give me a call that has a name right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. We may have struck out on that one, John. I haven't seen it. How many movies have you seen? And the movies you've seen where rockets take off, how many rockets have you seen? Is there any possibility that what you thought was a rocket was some kind of an atmospheric effect of the bomb itself? And where you saw the rockets, was it one of the small bomb tests or one of the really big ones? KC2WGB, K2LIW.
KC2WGB. Dick, I've noticed them on almost every test I've seen. You see that mushroom cloud. The rocket must be fired just before detonation because they go straight up. They leave a perfect vapor trail. And I know they know approximately how high they go. I thought they were only used for determining the altitude, but maybe they did carry instrumentation. That I don't know. But if you watch them, look out for them, you'll see at least five. They're usually to the left of the mushroom from the camera angle. But I am assuming they're on the right also, but maybe they get blotted out. But interesting. Interesting question.
These atomic blast videos that you've seen, John, was that something on YouTube? If I go to YouTube and I start looking at pictures of atomic blast, will I be able to see these rockets in those locations? Back to you, John.
I would say yes. I've never seen them on YouTube. I've never looked at them. But every test I've seen, I've always saw those rockets there. I never, you know, never thought to ask the question. I just thought they were for altitude. But that would be an interesting thing to find out. I think that's a good question. A lot of people, and a lot of people that I've talked to recently in the past week or so that I've questioned them about that, they didn't know. And that's part of their business, so I don't understand that.
That's where APG.
APG, go right ahead.
This is WA2ZOZ.
I'm just waiting for the beep. Alrighty, I'm to APG. Dick, you copy okay?
Roger, Dodger, Rep. Dave, go right ahead.
Stand by one. Alright, let's try this into APG. I just did a quick Google search, and apparently the rockets that are fired when they do an atomic blast, that's to, they study the propagation of the shockwave. They use the contrails apparently from the rockets, and they photograph the, you know, they photograph them, and they can tell, I guess, from the photography and the shockwave as it passes across the contrails.